Hello and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogic podcast with the Pop Culture Core on tour. I'm Mike Collins. I am a senior learning designer at the Open University, and we're at the Open University. We're at the Open University Library right now for the LDS Link event. And in this mini-series, we've been talking to people about books, the books they love and how they learn from books. But we're also now going to be talking about AI because we have the panelists from, it sounds like a game show now, but we have the panelists from an AI panel that has just been on at the Link event, and some fabulously interesting themes and things came out of it. So yes, I'm going to be interrogating everybody, but first, introductions. I am joined by...
Hi, I'm Aisling Third. I'm a research fellow at the OU's Knowledge Media Institute.
I'm Miriam Haug. I am one of two academic leads for generative AI in learning, teaching and assessment. My academic home is the School of Languages and Applied Linguistics here at the OU.
I'm Michelle Vermelinger. I'm a senior lecturer in computing, and I'm the other academic lead for generative AI in learning, teaching, and assessment.
So the AI panel earlier, really, really interesting. Some good stuff talked about. A lot of it's the projects that are happening or have happened around the university, the kind of the initiatives and the direction. Obviously, it's a very fast-moving space. I just got some really awkward questions, really, that came from it. Aisling, you mentioned at one point making education better with AI. How might AI make education just as a whole worse?
How could it make it worse? I mean, lots of ways. So, I mean, I don't particularly believe in being, like, a techno-optimist about AI, but also not a pessimist either. As with almost everything, it's a tool, and if you use it badly, you will get bad results. So, I mean, it's actually something Michelle mentioned earlier today was, you know, if students are using things like ChatGPT to answer assessment questions, and those assessment questions perhaps have been written by a lecturer using generative AI, and using a generative AI to assess it, you could just end up with the machines or just talking to each other. No one's learning anything. No one's
sort
doing
the,
anything.
Sort of the grey goo scenario.
Oh, yeah, it was just like, that's just a stupid thing to be doing. But it's not a non-zero risk. So it could absolutely make it worse in lots and lots of ways.
Any advances on that?
So, for example, another thing where it could get worse by using generative AI is to rely on the summaries made by generative AI so that we just be more productive, read more papers, but we are actually not reading them. We are relying on the summaries provided by generative AI, and like any summary, it could be not about the exact points that you need that are relevant for the work you want to do. So I don't think generative AI will save that much work in the end, at least the conceptual work, the creative work. So, but let's see.
Yeah.
I think there is an area where it could get better.
Ooh.
In the context of learning and teaching languages and cultures. Because for us, speaking anxiety, particularly for students who want to learn a language online and at a distance, is a big issue at beginner's level in particular. And it is now possible to use AI as a conversation partner. You can practice speaking with the chatbot. You can pretend to be somebody else. That also helps, you know? So any mistakes you make are not associated with you, at least not immediately. So I see great value in that respect, particularly in the languages and applied linguistics context.
I mean, it is a fantastically cool idea. I mean, because I went to school where they had the old cassette-based language labs things with the speaker repeat, whereas one that you can actually respond to you dynamically in the role of, for example, a bus driver in Lille would be pretty incredible. I mean, and you showed off earlier the 3D, the generated person video AI thing that you could... So presumably that's the sort of thing where you could literally be feel like you're having a one-to-one conversation with a person to develop those skills in a safe space, and then you obviously bust out into the real world and you go, people are in 3D now, but it's fine because I've practiced those. I mean, that is... that. There we go. We flipped it back to optimism, which takes me to the sort of, I guess, the future a little bit. Do you feel in the long term, like the direction that AI is taking us in is taking us in a kind of like slightly, from an education perspective, a utopian one where it's presenting a lot of new opportunities, a dystopian one where actually it's making things harder? Or actually is it just, as you say, it's just a new set of tools and it's going to be kind of the same as what we've got now but with better predictive text? What's your feeling on the direction of education and AI?
I think the rise of skills associated with using technology, generative AI in this particular case, and the rise in human skills, they will go upward or forward proportionally.
Mm.
Yeah, the more we have of the one, the more we will need of the other. It is just what we do with these human skills will probably change drastically.
Is that the old phrase, AI won't take your job, but the person who knows how to use it will, or something? Am I misusing that one?
No, I think we have to. These are different human skills that are needed. Or the focus will be on different skills. Like we've talked a lot about just now about prompting and evaluating output. So post-production editorial work, let's say, in a tertiary context, will become very important.
Mm.
So that you do something with what you see in front of your screen. And that you know what to do with it.
That critical engagement with it.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's something I think about quite a lot, is that a lot of the risks of using generative AI in education are if you take its output and just paste it into something. You know, people are very concerned about, people cheat. Using a generative AI to cheat. But the problem is to cheat well. So you use generative AI to create an essay. To cheat well, you have to be sure that that essay is up to date in the subject, that it cites correct references which are appropriate, that it makes a coherent and cohesive argument. And if you don't make sure as a learner that the essay you put in does that, you will get a bad mark. Whereas if you can critically interrogate what the AI gives you and understand it in the context of what you've learned, well, then you've demonstrated the things that the educator wanted you to get in the first place.
That's a very cool and progressive way of thinking about it, as opposed to the usual of, oh, Lord, the students are going to put this question into ChatGPT and it's going to spit out the answer. They're going to copy and paste it in and out.
And it will be bad if they do that.
And it has a flavour, doesn't it? You can smell stuff that's been done in AI. It's got a kind of like quite unique cadence to it, hasn't it?
For the time being.
Yes.
For the time being, the hallmarks of generative AI, the flowery language, the often superficial treatment of a topic, a lot of irrelevant information in the middle, never reaching a firm conclusion, always staying kind of balanced. For now, that will change, I'm sure.
Yeah. Unless, of course, AI keeps on referencing other AI for its training, which I think that's something that's happening now.
It is happening already.
Yeah. Yes.
But overall, coming back to your dystopian question, I think overall, if we humankind choose to use it well, it will be really a very powerful and useful tool. For example, so Miriam was mentioning the usefulness for dialogue in languages, but that also happens to any other subject. So for example, being a distance education institution, I notice sometimes in forums that the students cannot really express well the problem they are having, and somehow they are almost relying on us having telepathy to understand what is happening on their computer in front of them. And so I think having a dialogue with ChatGPT in their own home without anyone being judgmental about it will probably, hopefully, also help their communication skills on how to express a problem, how to pursue a solution, how to explore possible design spaces, other possibilities. So overall, I'm more optimist than pessimist, but yes, humankind, line managers can use this just as a productivity tool and get rid of staff, and thereby also of all the knowledge that staff has, the human touch gets lost, and then we are not really differentiating, the organizations are not that different than from each other. So there is that risk, but I'm optimist.
I really like that. And so, sort of mentioned the loss of the human touch. So, earlier on talked about Khan Academy and the like, which who've got their AI sort of tutor, study buddy.
KhanMigo.
KhanMigo. And sort of related kind of tools. And obviously one of the really cool opportunities is that, you know, in, for example, a distance learning setting, you could have your own one-to-one Socratic tutor on your shoulder helping you along the way. What is the, is there at the moment a measurable value to the human touch? Do people value it? Is it a positive or a negative? Is the consistency, for example, of an AI model worth more than the, you know, the human connection at a distance?
I think it's going to be a job share. I think the digital assistant will do all these things that take away from the pastoral care side of things. Yeah, the digital assistant will be very patient. You can ask the same question, try to find the same information over and over again. Particularly when you start studying with the OU, you are so overwhelmed with what comes at you in terms of information. Now imagine if all this organizing of this information and making it accessible in an easy way and in a patient way, that is what the digital assistant does. And then all the real emotional stuff is what the tutor can handle. The commitment, the engagement, the personalization in an emotional sense.
The human side.
Yeah, because the AI knows all the right words. It has been trained with all those kind of sites who tell us how to write nice cards for bereavement and everything like that. But they actually, they have never been ill. The AI has never been ill, has never felt bereavement, anything. So it's all fake empathy in a certain way. So like Miriam, I think the AI, it will not, whether the consistency is more valuable than the human touch. I think they will complement each other because our tutors, they also have, of course, their own lives. They are human beings. They can't be on call 24/7, whereas the AI, of course, is there at the time that the student needs. But then for other needs, the tutor is there. And I think for us, the jewel in the crown of the OU is really the tutors.
Can I add to that? I saw a slight note of caution about that that perspective, not in the sense that it wouldn't be amazing and should be how it's done, but I mean you see this in healthcare, for example, where the incorporation of technology into healthcare is often sold as this will free up healthcare professionals' time to do the patient-facing work, the emotional part, the support, the listening. All the actual direct care of a patient, and not things like, well, writing down blood pressure measurements and putting them in the notes, because that's a mechanical task. It's not something that needs a lot of time spent on it. In practice, what often happens is that managers see that we've incorporated this technology. It has freed up nurses' time, for example. We don't need as many nurses now. And now that's not to do with whether the technology is good for addressing that problem. It's to do with the economic structures in which we're sitting, forcing other things to happen. And actually talking to healthcare workers and talking to education specialists, you get the similar sort of things of, yes, this would be great if we could use it like this, but I'm really worried about my job. Yeah.
Can I just add to it, in our community of practice this morning, John Doming, a colleague of ours, says what he often says. Look, generative AI has arrived in the world as it is, okay? The world, it's not AI that is the challenge. It is the world that is the challenge. And if we are in a capitalist context and these are our drivers, you know, then of course nurses will be gotten rid of.
That's a bleak end game. I mean, but it's an interesting one because, I suppose, again, if we refer to AI as a tool, if somebody came in with a really efficient pencil, then there would be, unfortunately, some vampiric so-and-so somewhere going, how do I quantify this on a spreadsheet to work out how it's going to result in less man hours and improve my bonus? Or something equally sad. And, of course, health tech and ed tech share a kind of a dual problem in that the vampires who float around it, mostly based in the US, creating software solutions to things that weren't really problems and then trying to sell them to universities is a...
So John and I use... John Demang and I use the real problem is capitalism as a little bit of a slogan when we're giving talks about this, because it kind of is.
Well, I hope that generative AI will help those people become redundant.
I wanted to give a very personal example. As a mother of a 22-year-old who throughout his entire secondary school life in particular was in physical pain when he had to write a report, an essay, or any extended piece of writing caused enormous amount of stress. And something like speech to text or generative AI to have a few ideas, something in front of you that you can work with. I mean, that would have made such a difference. Now he's really scarred for the rest of his life, and he has this narrative in his head that he cannot write. And I think that will happen less and less and less with generative AI. And that's a good thing.
Again, so it's how it's used.
Yeah.
It's the context in which it's used. And it's, using brain and heart in equal measure.
Yeah.
And keeping the accountants away from it. Their spreadsheets. By the way, for balance, we've actually invited capitalism to join the panel now. No, okay, capitalism's staying quiet. We'll get capitalism on later. We'll dial them in.
Yeah.
So the Open University is the biggest, many would say the best, distance learning university based in Milton Keynes. Can't help myself. I'm naughty. We, as an institution... I think have a quite a unique relationship with the potential of AI, because we, as you know, to some extent, we're a kind of a content production house. We produce teaching, but teaching content, a lot of which people are looking at and going, oh, well, this could be, you know, bits of this can be generated, we can use this to support our work. But obviously AI as a tool and as a category of tools is evolving at a really rapid pace. Institutions like the Open University, we're only really now starting to crystallize the policies around it. How easy or hard, how do you think institutions such as the Open University are going to be able to keep a step ahead or keep up with the incredibly rapid progress in this space with policy and with training? Do you think they can?
Well, probably Miriam will have a slightly different opinion from mine, but in terms of training, I think it's important to understand a little bit how these tools work and why then they have the behavior they have. So yes, there needs to be some training. There needs also to be a little bit of training on the specific ways that specific tools can be used to get the best out of them. But there is really, I don't think, that much AI-specific training that is needed, because most of it is about being able to have a conversation with someone that we just found out maybe is a rocket scientist. So what would be the interesting questions that you would ask that person to get some interesting information and learn something about how rockets are built, for example? And also then also, of course, about being critical about what they are telling. And so the kind of critical reasoning skills that we need are also those that we need to pass discourses by politicians, by marketing industry. So there is some specific AI training that is needed, but the most of it, I think, will be on the critical thinking, on the biases, detecting biases, and so on.
So sort of to build up kind of like a, well, to build up and reinforce the general metacognitive skills that you'd expect a person to have to be successful in the use of any digital tool, rather than treating AI as this spooky magic thing.
Yeah, not just digital.
Yeah, exactly.
Tool.
It's more that we need colleagues to have the curious mindset, to be kind of a bit hungry, you know, for exploring. And this is actually that we need that kind of almost psychological training to be willing to engage with it.
In terms of what the OU can do, I mean, I think the OU's history itself is a lesson in this. So we've been you know, over 50 years we've been doing distance learning, and in that time distance learning technologies have changed. We're not doing 3 a.m. broadcasts on the BBC anymore.
I wish we were.
Everyone does. It'd be great. With the fashions, as they were. But we've adapted, and so, you know, the internet and then the web came along, and we've adapted to teaching on those and developed ways, like pedagogical principles for teaching in these environments and how best to use these tools to do education. And I think this is the same. It's a tool. We don't really yet know how to use AI well for pedagogy. We're going to. That's our job, is to find out. And we can build on those strengths because we've done this before a lot. It's kind of what we do. So.
Very optimistic.
Yeah, this kind of we'll find out.
Yes.
As long as we are in it together.
Yes.
That's why people hear me talk a lot about create an exploratorium. Yeah, not a training, but an exploratorium, a place where you can go and try things out and exchange your insights, your experiences with others who are also, in the first instance, there to try it out.
So you actually, this transitions me beautifully because you mentioned exploratorium earlier. It was one of 10, you had 10, not domains, I can't remember what they were called.
Types of roles that the chatbot in that particular case, ChatGPT rather, can play.
Mike Sharple's typology,
yeah,
that's the one.
Yeah, exploratorium is one.
Sorry, it came up on a slide and I looked at it like, this looks awesome. This is if anything, crystallizing a load of stuff where I've been like, oh, if we spend really long, we might just about land on one of these. But it crystallized like all the major use cases. It was wonderful. There'll be a link in the show notes. Is it public? Can I share it?
It is.
It is public.
Oh,
there'll definitely
be
a link in the show notes.
It is, yeah.
Do you know them all by heart?
No.
Oh, I
know many of them, but not by heart.
Because exploratorium.
Study buddy. Motivator. Dynamic assessor. Socratic opponent.
Guide on the side. That's one of them, isn't it? Guide on the side.
Yeah.
We're over halfway. That's sick. And the rest will be in the show notes, or possibly edited in, depending on how conscientious I am with the edit. So thanks. I'm conscious that I've had you sequestered in here for over 20 minutes now. Really appreciate your time. Would you mind if we just did a quick whiz round asking about books? This would have been my icebreaker, but the ice is broken. So now it's, I guess, the ice reformer. So obviously we're in the library. We're talking about books and how we learn from them. If you could scrub one book from your memory and read it again for the first time, what would it be?
I don't have any book in particular, but I remember when I was at school, so at the beginning of each year, we received the new books. And I was really always looking forward to that moment, not because of the book themselves as objects, like with covers or anything like that. But it was really about the material that I was going to learn about. So, for example, I went into computing, but I was fortunate to go through a German education where we had 10 to 12 subjects every single year. And then I went to a Portuguese higher education where this was before Bologna, where I also had 8 to 10 subjects every year. So I liked really learning the new stuff, whether it was ecology, whether it was about ethics, whether it was about history. So it's just, it's the anticipation of opening a book and looking just from the table of contents. Ooh, this is all the nice stuff that we are going to learn. So that's, I think that somehow gets lost a little bit, maybe with the, and you can immediately flick very quickly ahead and maybe get caught by a particular illustration or diagram that somehow gets lost in the digital.
Love it.
Yeah, I did an A-level in geography, and it's kind of my secret passion, geography. And the one book that anybody actually can read more than once is Tim Marshall, The Power of Geography.
I'll add this to my list.
Yeah, and he goes, and the next one, the sequel, is Prisoners of Geography. But The Power of Geography is so good because he goes from continent to continent, and he explains how the geographical conditions in each of these continents are responsible for where these countries on these continents are in terms of political development, social development, economic development. Very simple things like, is it a continent where the rivers go north, south mostly, or is it also a continent where the rivers go from west to east? So if you are in a country or on a continent where both happens, of course, the way trade developed, the way information could travel, and so on, yeah, totally different from a continent where that's not the case. So whether a country is more advanced or behind, depending on what your threshold is, or whether there is conflict, more conflict or less conflict, whether there's more education or less education, ultimately, you can explain it all with the geographical conditions on that continent or in a bespoke country in that on that continent.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome. I'll have to add this to my list. I want to say I started Why Nations Fail a while back, which had a big section on how geography affects.
Impacts.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay, well, that's on the list. I've got quite a big list building up from this series of recordings. Yeah. Ashley?
I feel quite lowbrow saying
You're not going to be the lowest brow answer. I think mine was a Terry Pratchett book.
And that's not lowbrow.
It was one of the great ones.
You've changed my answer.
Ooh,
also a Terry Pratchett book.
Ooh.
Actually, Night Watch.
What a book.
Yes.
What an incredible book. My friend still has my hardback copy and I'll never forgive him for not giving it back.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
I can't really say much more than that. It's just amazing. It really, really got me. That wasn't going to be my first answer, but yeah.
What was your first answer going to be?
The Time Traveler's Wife.
I've heard really good things. I've not read it.
Well, I read it on a long-haul flight where I'd spent the whole day tramping around a tourist site in Mexico. So I was exhausted. It was an overnight flight. And I just read for the entire flight. For some reason, I didn't sleep, which is strange because I usually do sleep on planes. So I was shattered reading this deeply moving, emotional book. And like landing in Gatwick, I think it was, in tears as I was finishing the book. Because it was like, it was so sad. But it was a really touching thing. I wouldn't say it's not necessarily my favourite book, but it was really, really good. And I found it very moving and heartbreaking. And I just had this unique experience with it. And I don't know, it stuck in my mind.
That's fantastic. And also, there is something very strange about consuming media on aeroplanes and making one emotional. I watched Interstellar for the first time on a plane. And I was in tears, which was in no way related to having been upgraded to first class and going through the whiskey menu. Anyway... thank you so much, everybody, for joining me. Where can people find... is there anything you want to plug, anything you want to share?
I mean, our student guidance on generative AI is publicly available, so other universities are also free to look at it. And we are going to, of course, also have some guidance on the critical use of AI.
Yeah, there is this framework that I've been working on with colleagues from the library, colleagues from LDS, Gen AI Learning Design, colleagues from Careers and Employability, which is about critical AI literacy skills, critical meaning through the equality, diversity, inclusion and access lens.
And you'll find a link to that. Is it shareable?
It is in draft stage, but it's shareable.
Okay.
The more people engage with it, the better.
You'll find a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah.
Ashley, anything you want to plug?
Just, I guess, the site where we're documenting all our experiments with AI for Education in the Knowledge Media Institute in KMI, so genai.kmi.open.ac.uk.
Well, thank you so much.
Welcome.
For joining me, Ashley, Miriam, Michelle. And thank you to you too for listening. You can find all of our recordings from this mini-series from the event at pedagogzilla.com, and if you work at the Open University, also on the LDS link intranet page. Mm. You can find all of the shareables that we've plugged. Wow, I'm really collapsing at the end of this. In the show notes, I've been Mike Collins. Big thanks to our guests, and we'll see you next time on Pedagogzilla. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.